Session number 11369, Peter Walpole, Reel 2.
Lieutenant Commander Peter Walpole, Reel 2. So when can you remember when it dawned on you that this was a real thing, that you actually were going to be engaged in real action, you know, having done all these exercises that you described? Sort of policing roles in the Gulf?
Well, again, I think one is reluctant to accept that there is about to be war, and so the realisation that we were likely to be involved in a shooting match probably didn't dawn on me until after the attack on the Belgrano, which really was only a couple of days beforehand, and many people would have seen the attack on the Sheffield in an almost retaliatory sense for what had happened to the Belgrano. But certainly that was the first major piece of shooting that we were aware that this was not going to be solved diplomatically.
Were you ever put on a tone that we are now on a war footing? It wasn't ever made definite. Were you given that sort of order?
Well, I don't think that... unlike, say, the Second World War or something, where war is officially declared and the sirens go and everyone dives down and all this sort of stuff. I don't think that ever really happened. But clearly on sailing into an area where the Argentinians had declared an area of exclusion, and so they didn't want us to come in there, and the battle lines were essentially being drawn up. And in that sense, the preparations on board, the fact the ship was in defence watches, the fact that we'd practiced action stations... I mean, that I think is about as close as we were ever going to get to it being real, as far as letting everyone know that it was.
Did it feel very different there from your earlier exercises?
Yes, it did. I remember, I think it was May the 1st, I remember very vividly the first occasion that we went to action stations that was for real, and my role was on the bridge as the second officer watch, I think, and the navigator was the officer watch. And there's a lot to do when you close up at action stations. There's checks to make sure everyone is there. And after all the checks, and we'd gone to action stations in a reasonable amount of time, because, again, the closing up can be quite a lengthy process, and we had practiced that to get it down to as short a time as we could. After that, there was a slight lull. There was a consciousness that there was potentially an air raid in progress. And there was just enough time after all the hurly-burly of closing up for me to stop and suddenly realise and say to myself, this is action stations for real, not for exercise, up to that point, of course, it had always been for exercise. So that was a revelation, I think.
Did you have any sort of sense or feeling about the justice of the cause? You know, does this sort of come to one at such moments as you're going into this situation?
All those questions of the justification and everything else are the sort of things that one would discuss with various people, perhaps when you're off duty, not so much when you're at action stations. But interestingly enough, at university, one of the modules I'd studied was called conflict analysis, and we had looked at the problem of the Falkland Islands. This was way back at the mid to late 70s. And already I was aware that the Argentinians had a claim on the islands themselves, and we had, in fact, we'd even spoken to people of the Falkland Island Company when at university to look at the structure of how the island was organised and what likely things would happen to it. And I was therefore well aware that one of the classic ways of diverting attention away from a country that is having problems at home domestically is to divert the attention of people to some unifying just cause that they see abroad. So I was well aware what the Argentinians were up to.
Did you have any particular feeling about the Argentinians at that stage?
Well, again, these were mixed, and we need to put them in their various categories. A little bit of history again. Prior to sailing from Portsmouth back in 1981, you're probably aware that the Argentinians also had two Type 42 destroyers, the Hercules and the Santissima Trinidad. Well, the Santissima Trinidad was in Portsmouth during 1981, conducting trials and her sea dart firings, which were done on British ranges. Clearly it was a British ship and all the equipment on board was British. And in dockyards, you normally tie up ships of the same class next to each other. So the Santissima Trinidad used to tie up next to us, and the Argentinians had all their cars on the jetty and most of their wives over because they were there for sort of 6 months doing their trials and testing. And I remember we even had them in the wardroom for drinks, all their officers. I remember standing in a group talking to them, and I had a much, from a very small sample, I had a feel for what the Argentinians were as a people. Basically, from essentially European stock, with Italians and German-looking people and some of the more classic swarthy dark types. But that, combined with the fact that we helped them with problems, we exchanged ships' plaques, and we had the plaque of the Santissima Trinidad hanging up outside the wardroom, meant that I think perhaps I had a far more of a perception that the Argentinian Navy is people, just like us, not as a group of mad bandolero-equipped gauchos. I mean, I was well aware they were competent people and that they had taken a Type 42 destroyer, taken it to sea and conducted successful missile firings. And they were able to operate the ship systems. So in that sense, we had a small association with some of the people involved as well. Certainly I felt that it would be most unfortunate if we were to ever come across the Santissima Trinidad in action, people we'd had in the wardroom not a year previous, sharing jokes and drinking and socialising, which really just brings it home to you that the military are just pawns in the politician's game, and we'll be moved around as the politicians see fit.
Did you have any special anxieties about the Argentinians, really, the weaponry you knew they had? Was there anything in particular that you remember bothering the Sheffield?
Nothing in particular, I think, but just recalling what I'd said about the crew of the Santissima Trinidad, I was in no doubt that they were competent people and able to operate complex equipment. Often there were people on board who perceived the Argentinians as just a bunch of cowboys, a bunch of gauchos, who would be a complete walkover. But I think, really, the evidence we had suggested otherwise.
To the issue of communications and intelligence, you were saying earlier, you know, the dearth of intelligence at this time. I was wondering also, you know, did this improve at all? Were you getting more intelligence about the Argentinians as you went south? Would you say you were?
Yes, I mean, we were very conscious that there are a lot of people back in UK doing their very best to get us the latest information they could, but that they had started from a very poor position, and so it was a long, hard slog to get that information. But what they had was certainly being given to us as quickly as they could get it.
Because this was very much a sole British effort, wasn't it, the Falklands? You know, and I wondered if you had any feelings or expectations about the role of the United States at any time in offering assistance in any way to the Navy.
Well, I sort of was well aware of the American position, that clearly the other South America or South American and Central American states and the United States itself are all part of a particular political grouping, and that clearly they could see both sides. We were obviously hoping that what is known as the special relationship would at one stage come into play, and that the Americans would perhaps get off the fence and help their old allies rather than the South Americans. So, yes, I mean, that was what we were hoping would happen, but I was well aware of the American embarrassment at being put in the position. And obviously they were trying very hard with old Alexander Haig doing his famous shuttle.
They did impose sanctions, I believe, didn't they, the Americans? Were you aware of that? Against the Argentinians?
Yes, probably. Probably aware. I must say I can't recall it at the moment. I remember the Italians being a bit wavering in their support of UK in the European Community Directives, not least of all, I suppose, because the Argentinian cattle provides Italian Gucci shoe companies with so much leather.
It's very interesting, I think. You seem very aware of the political situation. You know, is this for the benefit of hindsight, or were you really getting this from your well-viewed source?
No, I think a lot of it had to do with the conflict analysis studies I did at university and a general desire to always stay abreast of what's happening. I think with that knowledge I was able to perhaps put my own interpretation on some of the things I was hearing over the World Service.
So let me ask you now, when you arrived in the war zone and the Falklands themselves, you first saw the islands. What was your impression of the place? What are they like, the Falkland Islands?
Well, I never saw the islands during 1982 at all. It wasn't until I returned in 83, 84 that I actually got a chance to go ashore. The closest I got to ever seeing the islands in 1982 was on radar. And I remember on the morning of the attack taking a fix that included using one of the longer range radars to try and pick up some land, because we were operating southwest of the islands. And I seem to remember it at about 50 to 60 miles off a piece of land that we could just about pick up. But you have to be careful when you're using the radar, because sometimes the radar picks up only the mountain top some way in from the edge of land. So I never got to see the islands in 82. Bit of a shame. But it was nice to see them in 83 and 84 and actually have a look around. Although I have to say I found South Georgia far more beautiful than the Falkland Islands.
So does this take us now, do you think, to the sinking of the Belgrano? Shall we talk about that? Because it seems to have been, that was May the 2nd, wasn't it, a couple of days?
Yes, it was only a couple of days beforehand. To be honest, I can't remember what my recollection is of where the Belgrano group was at the time, and obviously I know that subsequently it's caused a lot of political debate. Certainly there were a lot of bantering in the House of Commons about it, and has been ever since. But clearly down there our perceptions were different. But I do remember on reading the signal that said that the Belgrano had been attacked and sunk, I do remember feeling a certain doom, because it to me signalled the start of a major shooting war. I mean, I think prior to that there had been shots exchanged, not just in Stanley and the invasion and the taking and the countering the Marine force that was there, but also in South Georgia when the Marines again countered the Argentinians when they came in, and the shooting down of helicopters and things. But really, to sink a major battleship or a cruiser like the Belgrano meant that, I mean, it meant to all of us that the shooting was really underway for the big ships, and that meant us.
Did it make any difference, do you think, this business about the exclusion zone, that the Belgrano was outside that?
Well, really, that in a sense is almost a political question, because we in all our operations obviously are controlled by rules of engagement. We only do exactly what the politicians want us to do, and if the military criteria had been met and the rules of engagement satisfied, then clearly it's almost not a decision. But obviously the loss of any life at sea is regrettable, and one's heart went out to the Argentinian sailors floundering around in the cold water of the South Atlantic on a dark night. Very sad.
Was it perceived as a big threat, this particular ship, by you, do you think?
Not by me personally, but that's probably due to a lack of knowledge. Clearly it may well have been perceived as a threat to our efforts by the higher staff and the Admiral. But to me personally at that stage, not particularly, but then perhaps I never really got used to exactly how big of a threat the whole of the Argentinians constituted at that stage.
Had have you changed your sort of perception of it? You did say earlier, my perception at the time. So, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and what you've read about it, have you changed your opinion of the Belgrano incident, would you say?
Well, I suppose really I found out more about it afterwards than I did at the time. I mean, essentially, there was a terse little signal saying that the Belgrano had been sunk. And one's immediate reaction was obviously regret at the loss of life and the fact that this meant a shooting war for the surface ships involved. I suppose then you have to say, well, or one did say that essentially this means that there's fewer ships to counter us, and therefore the potential threat has gone away. And on another level, I would have hoped that by perhaps shooting at a major surface ship like that, the Argentinians would have thought again, and that perhaps there was still some hope for a peace initiative, although if I remember rightly, the peace initiatives had broken down by the time the Belgrano was sunk. What else? Yes, I mean, all the sort of political furore that was went on in the House of Commons was really stuff that happened later in many senses, and at the time, on hearing it, I didn't have much time for it, although obviously in a democracy one should debate all these things endlessly. It's a regrettable loss, but obviously the military commanders saw it as the only way forward.
So from the date of the 2nd to the 4th, what were you doing in that sort of interim period?
The Sheffield remained an air defence role and was stationed to the west of the main task force, the three, Glasgow, Coventry and Sheffield, the three Type 42 destroyers were all in a sort of arc out to the west, conducting our sort of air defence role, the surveillance, the patrolling our sector, our assigned box of ocean, as it were. So I remember that. But I must say that the days between the Belgrano and the day of the sinking are pretty blurred. I don't remember much about them.
You haven't mentioned the carriers, have you? The aircraft carriers. Did you ever catch sight of them?
Yes, in fact, I seem to remember on the day of the 4th being able to just about make out the Hermes, although I didn't see the Invincible. So, yes, just about on the horizon, a very distinctive shape, the Hermes. We were obviously keeping station on her, but mainly through the use of radar, not by visual means.
I'm sure a lot of people sort of picture the task force as something altogether, like a shoal of fish.
Well, it is essentially, but the business of scale means that it is all split up. Now you've made me remember, I do actually recall the being able to make out the Hermes and the aircraft that took off in the bombing raid against Stanley when the famous quote about I counted them all out and counted them all in came from one of the reporters. So I remember that. It's always stuck in my mind. There's something reporters do with drinks as well.
Did you have much to do with reporters at this stage?
No, very little. We didn't have any on board. I think they seemed to be... There were maybe one or two in the Hermes on the flagship, but the vast bulk of the press corps really joined the flotilla that sailed from the UK, the QE2, the Canberra, and sort of the second wave of ships that came down.
You mentioned the attack on Stanley. You know, what was that? Did it affect morale at all, the fact that that had happened?
I remember us all being faintly amused at the RAF bombing raid on Stanley with their Vulcan bombers they managed to drag out of retirement and in their desperate bid to get involved and flog all the way down there and drop a whole lot of bombs, which essentially missed. But I seem to remember it was declared a success at the time. The bombing of Stanley on the 1st, I think also there were a series of ships that went in to conduct naval gunfire support bombardment as well, some of whom got strafed by ships and got cannon and rocket fire against them. I think the plan to conduct NGS was reviewed after day one. But yes, we were aware that there were aircraft that could have been based there, or that they could have used the runway that we didn't need with vertical takeoff aircraft. So I think really, if the war was going to take place, we'd obviously much rather get our aircraft to take part.
It's interesting also your attitude towards the RAF. You know, I wondered if there was a sort of sense of inter-service
rivalry. Oh, I think there always is and always has been. I've subsequently worked for the RAF and actually have a lot of respect for them in many ways. But I found the Vulcan raid rather amusing.
Yes, I couldn't help smiling when you were talking about the Vulcan bombers, because I was thinking of your two carriers. You know, perhaps 6 months later, you might not have had.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, I think the Invincible was up for sale just before the Falklands. In any case, this may happen again, of course.
Well, I think this brings us to May the 4th, doesn't it?
Yes.
And if you could take me through the events of the day as you remember them.
Right, well, what a lot of people on board back in UK didn't realise is that we were actually keeping Greenwich Mean Time on board the ships. They were translating it to what they thought the time scale was we were keeping. But essentially this meant that by the time daylight came, we were all up, awake, had breakfast and were ready to go for the day. I had the afternoon watch, which goes from after lunch to about tea time, 4 o'clock. And before taking up the watch, the officer watch visits the operations room and has a brief from the on-watch warfare officer, and also a discussion of what is happening over the next few hours, anything that's taking place. And I remember talking to the warfare officer, Graham Tolley, and also looking at the chart that's kept down there. It's a sort of a plot. And on it, I distinctly remember seeing a small red submarine. I suppose we drew things in red because of the enemy, but the Argentinians were drawn in red. And I think it was the San Luis, one of the small German 206-class submarines that was in a position, or had been reported in a position within the last 24 hours, from which she could have easily reached where we were that afternoon. And bearing in mind the sea state, which was actually quite calm, although it had a long remnant of a swell on it, visibility was really quite reasonable, I suppose, about 8 or 9 miles. And discussed the fact that perhaps the greatest threat, as perceived that afternoon, would have come from a submarine. Clearly no indication of air activity at the time, although an air raid can build very quickly, whereas a submarine takes a long time to get anywhere. So I do remember going on watch, thinking that one of the most important things to do would be to keep a good visual lookout, as my contribution and the bridge's contribution, within what is known as the look zone, where the submarine captain sticks his periscope up for that last look at you before firing the torpedo, which is probably within the order of 2 to 6 miles away from the ship. And the periscopes can be spotted. Many of the visual sightings of the last war were by a visual means of the periscope, not of sonar. So well aware that that was something we would have to do. I remember taking over the watch, briefing the bridge team that's what we were all to look out for. And up on the bridge was the leading physical trainer, Steve Yakavu. I remember being the quartermaster, the man who steers the ship. And also Sub-Lieutenant John Woodward was the second officer of the watch. There was a radio operator and a bosun's mate. And I remember that the helicopter was at alert, where the crew had to be either in the operations room or on the bridge. And so the flight observer came up to the bridge with the flight commander. The flight observer is a good friend of mine, Al Clark. And we would have probably listened to the World Service news. We would have probably listened to the World Service news. And then the sort of watch got underway. I actually delegated the conduct of courses and speed and manoeuvring to the second officer watch, who's a young sub-lieutenant under training, and took on a sort of overseeing role myself, which is quite common on board ships. And was chatting to Al Clark, and he was up there in his flight overalls, ready to go at a minute's notice. And we were scanning the horizon. And I remember the first indication of anything untoward happening was one of the people in the operations room detecting aircraft where they didn't expect to see them. In fact, it was Lieutenant Colin Haley, the fighter controller, I believe, whose voice I heard reporting bogies, the code name for unidentified aircraft, subsequently made famous in Top Gun, of course. And also I heard the PWO calling for the AWO, the anti-air warfare officer, in the ops room. And this was sufficient to alert the bridge staff that something was happening, although what, we were not sure. And one would turn up the speaker and start scanning, looking around, trying to listen intently to all the reports coming up. And we gathered that there were two air contacts somewhere off to the northwest, as reported by the fighter controller. It's worth saying here that helicopters, our own helicopters that transit around the force, do so at about 400 feet. And we're a frequent sight clattering along the horizon, little sort of black dots moving around. And I think the first indication that a missile was coming towards us was probably visual. Having been alerted that something was happening out towards the northwest, we started to scan the horizon. But that all I saw was something rather strange, something I'd really never seen before.